Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Geek Warning Podcast from the Escape Collective, your one-stop shop for everything you need to know this week in the world of bicycle tech. Seattle Classic Trade Show kicks off this week, and I'll have a whole bunch of tech galleries on the site covering all the latest and greatest gear that's on display there. Even though that event hasn't yet started as we're recording this episode, though, there's already a whole bunch of stuff to talk about today. So on today's docket, we've got a brand new gravel bike from Kona, and following up on last week's show, we've got yet more high-end all-road slash endurance road bikes, this time from the Custom Wizards at 51 over in Ireland, and the second coming of Parley Cycles. Pretty interesting there. Trek also has a new rear-facing radar unit designed to go head-to-head against the Garmin Varia. DT Swiss is upping its engagement speed game again with a revamp of its iconic Star Ratchet hubs. And then we're also going to debate the pros and cons of paint on bikes that don't really need it. We got a PSA related to those sadly neglected dropper posts. Then a bunch of other little bits of news to round out the show. I'm James Huang. I'm actually not in Boulder, Colorado this week. I'm in Monterey, California for Sea Otter. Joining me on today's show is Escape Collector Senior Tech Editor Dave Rome, who's also not in Sydney. Dave, where are you?
Somewhere in Perth at the moment. Just a brief stop to celebrate someone turning 95. It's been a wild week. Wild week.
Sounds like quite the party. I'm wondering, how's the tool selection in Perth?
I couldn't tell you. I've been being dragged to endless numbers of cafes, and I'm feeling a little ill from it, really. I'm looking forward to returning home and not going to cafes four times a day.
Nice, nice. Well, speaking of ill,
that's such a first world problem. I'm sorry.
Speaking of being ill, I maybe seem to have developed bronchitis. So my apologies if my voice is still not quite what it used to be. Dave, what is coming up in your next threaded newsletter?
Still to be determined. I've got 7 days to work that out.
Oh, plenty. So you've got what, like 6 days to figure it out, and then a day of frantic writing and photos shooting?
Pretty much, and without sleep. Yeah, I'll probably do internal cable routing, but we'll see. That is not going to be an easy one to photograph in a useful manner. So we'll see if I can get there in time, but that's the plan.
Why don't you do an entire threaded column solely dedicated to partially internally routed mountain bikes with full internally guided tube-in-tube routing? It'll be a very quick episode. It'll be a very quick newsletter.
Full praise.
Yep. Stick it in one end and it comes out the other. Done.
Yeah. Unless you're talking about like a 4 or 5 year old bike that's now covered in grit and dirt and that cable housing stuck in there.
Even the perfect answer
isn't perfect.
He's got to ruin it, Dave. All right, let's go ahead and get into the news while I can still speak. All right, first up, I think it's safe to call this brand groundbreaking. So groundbreaking mountain bike brand Kona Bicycles has been showing signs of floundering over the last few months, but it's now actually showing signs of life again in the form of a new carbon gravel bike called the Ouroboros. And as you'd expect, it's very much a mountain biker's gravel bike. So Dave and I were wondering what an Ouroboro was. So in case you're wondering, an Ouroboros is a circular symbol that depicts a snake or dragon devouring its own tail that's used especially to represent the eternal cycle of destruction and rebirth. I'm not really sure what that has to do with gravel riding, but if you happen to look at the promo video for the Ouroboros, it's a bit dark and seems kind of fitting. Anyway, this bike. So as I mentioned, it is very much a mountain biker's gravel bike. It's got a ton of tire clearance. So Kona says it'll fit at least a 700x53. It'll actually fit a 700 by like a 2.5 inch tire up front with the rigid carbon fork, if you go that route. Most of the models come with front suspension. It's got 180 mil rotors up front. It's compatible with dropper seat posts, but I think it's a 31.6 seat post diameter, so you can fit a whole bunch of stuff in there. The handling is very much mountain bike style, long reach, short stem, kind of slacker head tube angle. It's also got a ton of mounts, including hard points inside the front triangle for frame bags. Kona does specifically say custom frame bags, so it doesn't sound like they've actually gone out and made their own for this, which is a little bit of a bummer. But anyway, either way, you do have the option to run frame bags without straps. It actually sounds like a pretty fun bike. I don't really know how light it's going to be. It's probably not going to be very light, but it's clearly just sort of, it's clearly a gravel bike that is purpose-built for underbiking. But it does sound fun.
Yep. The geometry stood out to me. It's like 69.5 degree head angle. Kind of stood out to me of how much or how far ahead the BMC Urs was compared to everyone else. Like how defining of a gravel bike that was in a category. Because a lot of gravel bikes coming out now, a lot of mountain bikes sort of leading or leaning gravel bikes coming to the market seem to be landing on the figures that BMC Urs did, what, 4 or 5 years ago now?
Yeah, something like that. Maybe even more. I can't remember now.
But the big difference was sure. tire clearance. That Urs was limited to like 700 by 40-ish, 42s. And yeah, I mean, this Kona is a vastly different bike when you're talking about a, you know, fitting a 29 by 2.1 inch tire in it.
It's clearly, I mean, if you look at that promo video, I think it's pretty clear what Kona is trying to do with this. It's definitely more of like a shreddy, adventure-y, head out into the woods sort of gravel bike. It's not a, you know, try and get a PR at Steamboat Gravel or yeah. Unbound or something like that. I mean, you obviously could use it for that, but that's just clearly not what it's really meant for. There's no mention of it being like aero or stiff or so on and so forth. I mean, it's sort of, again, it's like a mountain biker's gravel bike and very fitting with the whole Kona ethos. But yeah, it does sound fun. Maybe we'll bring one in. We'll see. Either way, it's nice to see some life out of Kona, because I think the last time we talked about them was when they were running their buy one, get one sale on like mm-hmm. higher end mountain bikes, which was pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for them to come out with a brand new carbon gravel bike is a good sign. So hopefully, fingers crossed, this is a sign of things to come from Kona. Another new bike. So we talked a whole bunch on last week's show about the kind of the almost like the flood of higher end endurance road / all road bikes that have been hitting the market. And pretty much on cue, we've got another one to add to the pile. This one from the custom carbon frame experts in Dublin, Ireland, 51 bikes. Mm. Dave, what's the story here?
Yeah. So they make custom carbon bikes like tube to tube custom carbon bikes in Ireland, but they also a couple of years ago released a stock geometry stock frame, which was actually made in Asia, the Assassin, which is their gravel bike, and it's pretty cool gravel bike with like geometry chips in the fork and in the rear stays and a lot of nice features. It was a nice enough bike that I reviewed one, and then a few months later I actually ended up purchasing one. And it remains my gravel bike today. So yeah, I've had a great experience with that. It's just been super solid. But they've now released a road bike. So yeah, kind of an all-roady bike. It's the Sika, S-I-K-A. But yeah, it's got some very classical 51 cues, namely with the seat stays, which are sort of an open wishbone design. So each seat stay individually goes up to the seat tube, but with some nice little curvature to it, which is a cool little design feature. But yeah, it looks like a good all-road bike. It's got room for 40 mil tires. It's got all the features that you'd probably look for in a road bike today, as in T47 thread bottom bracket. It's got internal cable routing through the headset. It's got a UDH derailleur hanger. And then yeah, if you look at the geometry, gets a little weird for me, to be honest. It's sort of claiming to be a road bike for all, where it's, you know, a bit more relaxed geometry. But for me, that doesn't really apply to every size. So if I'm looking at the medium size that I'd ride, I think it rings true. But then the next size up, it jumps by a whole 10 millimeters in reach and probably gets a little bit long for some people. So yeah, but I think it is a pretty interesting looking bike, and it is rather pretty with like a raw finish to it. And I guess the other big selling feature is that they're claiming a 690 gram frame weight, which is mm-hmm. rather yep. impressive.
For a medium, yeah. Yeah, I mean, 51's also saying that it sounds like it rides particularly comfortable, mm-hmm. Which may have something to do with the way they're doing those seat stays.
Yeah, and the slightly unusual looking fork.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I guess in a nutshell, so 51 is describing this as a, quote, cutting edge road bike that delivers top level performance in a package tailored for real riders, not for pros, and combines feathery lightness, high stiffness, and sleek aero with a less extreme position, confident handling, and clearance for 40 millimeter tires, unquote. Mm-hmm. That could pretty much apply to every other bike that we have talked about over the last couple of weeks, I feel like. Like, why does it seem like, is it just me, or are we actually seeing a flood of high-end road bikes that are very explicitly being marketed as being not for pros?
Yeah, it's not just you. And I think from a business case, it makes sense given the pros aren't the ones buying the bike.
I mean, it just seems like we're seeing so much more separation between the two, whereas before they were so intertwined.
For sure. I guess, yeah, and that's absolutely true. And I fully encourage the industry to continue down this path, and that it a lot of race bikes are not the ideal bike for the everyday rider, road rider, namely in the geometry. But I would also say a lot of these bikes, it's becoming more and more important to pay attention to the fit figures available on each of these bikes and what length stem they come in and what length handlebar reach comes with it and the seat tube angle and all these different elements of geometry. I think it's more and more important now because a lot of these bikes are claiming to be more accessible fit. And to be honest, some of these, including this 51, probably more sit toward the racy end still, while say that new Envy we spoke about last week really has an increased stack height where you can see that fit is truly more accessible. So yes, there's bikes here for everyone, but it's worth paying attention to because there are, you know, 2-3 centimeter differences that we're talking about for an equivalent size in between, when you're talking about the height of the handlebars.
Yep. Get acquainted with the numbers because not surprisingly, this thing is not inexpensive. So 51 quoted a price of 4,500 US or £3,950 for a frame set, which includes a seat post and 51's own proprietary one-piece integrated cockpit. Mm-hmm. So you do want to make sure you get those numbers right, and they're going to start delivering these things in June. So we'll see what these look like.
A feature on this, which I think was also a feature we saw with the Envy last week, a regular 27.2 diameter round seat post.
Indeed.
I quite like that on a bike like this. It just simplifies things. It means if you hold on to the bike for 10 years, you're not ever going to struggle to get a replacement seat post that's proprietary to the frame. Yes, there are advantages to D-shaped seat posts, but I quite like just knowing that I'll always be able to get a seat post for one of these.
Yep, I agree. So yet another endurance road / all-road bike that came out this week. Maybe from an unexpected brand name. It's from Parley. Yeah. So that American brand filed for bankruptcy protection in early 2023. It was then purchased by an American investor and an apparent fan of the brand named John Harrison later that year. And now it's unveiling a new bike called the Ouray with what should now seem like a pretty familiar theme. So it's apparently a true monocoque carbon fiber frame, meaning the whole thing is built and laid up as one piece as opposed to being laid up in sections and cured and then bonded and, you know, kind of overwrapped and recured again. So the frame was designed by original Parley founder Bob Parley, who is working on kind of like more like a consultation design basis for the company. The frame is now made in Western Europe instead of the US or Asia, which is new for Parley. Hmm. It's got a claimed frame weight of less than 900 grams, so it's not meant to be a super light bike. And supposedly offers a super smooth ride. Geometry is fairly relaxed with, again, taller stack, shorter reach, fully internal routing, again, like T47 threaded bottom bracket, UDH out back. Again, like this is sounding all very familiar. Mm-hmm. So one interesting detail that stood out to me on this is that the front brake mounting holes are sized for 180 or 160 mil rotors instead of the usual 160, 140 mil, which to me is a good trend in my opinion, because I don't know anyone who runs 140 mil front rotor.
Mm, they're still around.
At least, you can get away with it in flatter areas and lighter riders for sure. But for the most part, I'd say there are far more people who can make use of a 180 mil front rotor than can get away with a 140. Mm-hmm. Either way, Parley is offering this in 5 sizes. So it seems like a little bit on the kind of limited range for Parley. What is interesting is they're offering this with just kind of like they're calling it a nude finish. It's an aerospace wax, they're saying. It's not actually a clear coat. Kind of want to dig into this a little bit, but custom paint is available. Pricing is $5,300 for a frame set US, complete starting just under 7K. So they're going to have one here at Sea Otter. So I'll get a bunch of pictures of that. And 51's also going to have that Sika here at Sea Otter. So I'll make sure to get pictures of that as well.
I mean, speaking of Sea Otter, we didn't mention that you are going to be running around snapping photos of things at Sea Otter over the next few days.
Oh, no, I did. I said I was in Monterey instead of Boulder. But yeah, I'm going to see how well my voice holds up for doing a whole bunch of talking over the next 3 days. But yes, by the time you hear this podcast, there will almost certainly be 1, maybe 2 tech galleries up on the site. So make sure you head over to escapecollective.com because there'll be a whole bunch of stuff on there.
Mm. And it's probably worth mentioning that's why we're seeing this flood in the last few weeks. It feels very news heavy on these episodes. And it's simply the build up to Sea Otter. I mean, Sea Otter's become like short, you know, in addition to Eurobike, it's the only other time of year that brands really desperately try to release new products. And we've suddenly seen this overwhelming flood of new product as I get the feeling brands have sort of held back a lot of these over the last year or two. And so they've released the floodgates now, and it's been busy on the tech front. So sorry that these episodes are so tech heavy, but there's a lot of new things that we're just trying to bring attention to.
Speaking of new products, there's yet another one. It's not a bike this time. This one's related to road safety. So I kind of hate the term game changer because it gets tossed around all over the place. But I think this one actually applies when we say that Garmin actually did really change the game when it introduced the original Varia radar in like 2015. It's been quite a while now.
But they certainly brought it to prominence.
But it's absolutely dominated the market ever since. So it's been almost 10 years now. Yeah. And in that time span, despite how popular a product that is, there have been, I'd say, pretty surprisingly few products to compete against it. That's slowly starting to change. And Trek is the latest brand to give it a try with this thing, a new product called the Carback. Like the Varia, the Carback's designed to alert you when cars are approaching you from behind. Trek says it'll detect cars at up to 240 meters away. And then you get the usual audible and on-screen alerts with compatible computers. There's also an app, so you can use it with your phone instead. It's got a built-in daytime running light that kind of follows the standard Trek/Bontrager intermittent flashing pattern that we really like, that we've used quite a lot over the years. And Trek says that visible up to 2K away. So pretty darn bright. As far as why someone might be interested in this versus a Garmin, so it's a little shorter in height than a Varia, a little bit wider left to right, comes with a pretty nice seat post mount that fits on a whole bunch of different frame and seat post shapes, and USB-C rechargeable. It's got like a built-in four-step LED fuel gauge, which is kind of nice, and it's $200, so not too bad. I'd say I've only used it a couple times now. Trek thankfully sent out some samples a little bit early. I do love that there are some more options in this category coming. But I think Garmin set a pretty remarkably high bar in terms of how well its radar works. Like, you pretty much never hear people complaining about getting like false alerts or cars approaching when you're not alerted and that sort of thing. So I've only used my Trek sample a couple of times, but I'm actually been a little disappointed. It seems like it has a lower detection range than what I'm used to with Garmin. And it also seems a little bit more finicky in terms of placement and aiming.
And also a little bit heavier, you said?
It is a little bit heavier. I can't remember what the runtime is. I think the runtime might be a little bit longer. It's funny because like Trek talks about the form factor as it being a positive, but yes, it is shorter top to bottom, but I kind of like how the Varia is kind of narrow. Like it's kind of more like a stick, whereas this is kind of more like a deck of cards sort of shape. Like it's it's shorter, but it's also fatter.
Do you think some people rub their legs on it with it being wider?
Not really. I don't think just because it's behind the seat post. I mean, it certainly is possible. The last time I ran it, I was actually using it on a mountain bike, and to keep from having issues with tire rub or seat post rubbing when the saddle was dropped, I oftentimes will take a rear flasher and kind of flip it around forward on the seat post when I'm out on the trail, just to kind of get it out of the way. And then in that orientation, it definitely kind of rubs a little bit. I'd say that's probably pretty unusual. I mean, I would guess most people don't do that though. So I don't really I'm not sure that that's even worth mentioning. But yeah, like I need to play with this some more. I definitely still have high hopes for it, but I'm not sure it's going to knock Garmin off the top step.
Should I share my grumpy person's view as to why this really exists?
Absolutely.
My cynical view is that Garmin historically hasn't left a lot of meat in the margin for retailers. They typically run pretty lean between the wholesale and retail price, which is why you don't typically see Garmin at big discounts, because there just isn't that much room to play with. And also they control their pricing, but that's a different matter. I think this product for Bontrager exists as a way for Trek dealers, Trek stores, many of which are now vertically integrated, to make a proper margin on selling radar units. I would argue the same for why they have a lot of other products, but especially this.
We talked about this a while ago when I reviewed those newer Trek mountain bike pedals that were, they were designed in collaboration with Look. Mm-hmm. Those pedals are totally fine.
Yep.
They work pretty well, but like it didn't really seem like there was much of a reason for them to exist, except when you look at it from that dealer perspective. And then from that perspective, then they very much have a reason to exist. And if I were a Trek dealer and I was presented an option of a radar product that I could make a lot more money on, I know which one I'd be pushing.
And that's all good as long as it works, right? So if this ends up proving itself and ends up perhaps a firmware update makes it as effective as the Garmin and keeps it that way, then that's great. But if it is an inferior product in that sense from its pure core function of notifying you of cars behind you, then unfortunately, not great.
Yeah, it certainly could be better so far. Again, I'm going to play with it some more. I'm not ready to write it off just yet, but I will say that Garmin definitely has very clearly defined guidelines for how it wants you to mount and position its Varia radar. And I will freely admit that I often don't follow those guidelines, but it still works just fine. It seems to be remarkably tolerant of where you put it and aim it and that sort of thing. And haven't noticed that with this Trek Carback just yet. So, a buddy of mine that I was riding with the other day, he had unfortunately made the little joke that it seemed like this thing only gave you about as much detection to like kind of brace yourself to get hit. Again, maybe it's placement. Maybe I just need to kind of play with it a little bit more. But to be determined, but we'll see.
Okay. Of these is a good thing. So hopefully they sort that out.
More of these is a good thing, but the way this sort of thing works, the segment is only going to be advanced if a real true competitor comes out. And again, if this thing doesn't actually compete head to head with Garmin in terms of function, then I'm not really going to see a whole lot of motivation from Garmin to make the Varia any better. But I mean, in fairness, it works pretty well already. So even if it didn't get any better, you know, that would still be okay.
Just on this is one product that I think it not working is so much worse than not having it at all.
Oh, 100%. Like that false sense of security.
Yeah.
And the thing for me, like because I test a lot of products, because I know I'm kind of prepared for things to not always work.
Yeah.
I had it running, and yet at the same time, like normally with the Varia, I've kind of gotten into the habit of, you know, maybe trusting it too much. So I still never just kind of turn without looking back, or like veer into the lane without looking back. But I have learned to really trust it, because honestly, I don't think it's ever let me down once. Yep. Like I don't think I've ever had a car approach that it didn't warn me about.
Right.
But with this, I was definitely looking behind pretty regularly just to check and see if it was working. And oftentimes it wasn't working the way I wanted it to. I would agree. Like I, for a safety item like that, if it were to not alert you or not work the way that it's supposed to,
100% of the time. Yeah.
It's just not great. It's like that Asian brand Majin, they came out with a radar as well, and the reviews on that seem to be not quite stellar. And that seems to be another product again, which maybe gives a false sense of security. So hopefully this doesn't completely fall into that category. But again, I need to play around with it a little bit more. But I wish my first impressions were a little bit more positive.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, let's talk about hubs again. Last week, we talked about Project 321. Mm. And this time around, it's a much, much bigger brand that's got a hub story to talk about. What's the scoop?
It is. It's a new startup called DT Swiss. And they've got the original Star Ratchet design, which is two independently sprung ratchets that sort of bind in together when you pedal forward. Those have been around for, I think, 25 years now. They've always been a little bit limited in terms of the number of engagement points. They started at 18, and for years and years and years and years, decades even, they stayed at 18 tooth engagement points, which was 20 degrees. And then they released quite a few years ago at this point, 36 tooth ratchet rings, which you could upgrade your old hubs with, and then 54 tooth ratchet rings. But that's kind of the highest I've been able to go, because even those 54 tooth, you occasionally get reports of people getting some skipping, you know, bigger, heavier riders or riders living in cold conditions where the grease gets sticky. You do hear of those 54 tooth rings binding, but it's a size limitation of that Star Ratchet. And they've just released a mountain bike specific version of their hub. It's called the DEG, and it's running significantly larger ratchet rings inside of it. And they now have a 90 tooth engaging ratchet rings as a result of it. And I felt it was big enough news that it's, I have been testing these hubs, and yeah, I've got a full written review on Escape Collective, but we've also got a full Geek Warning podcast with, some members from DT Swiss about these hubs, how they fit into the range, and, spoke about other things, spoke choice, where the new Revo Light and Comp Light spokes fit into the range and why you pick those. And also finally an official explainer on the hierarchy of DT Swiss wheels.
Perfect. In terms of naming.
Yep. Yep. So what the letters mean, what the numbers mean. So yeah, we got the official answer. So no one now email in and tell me I got it wrong again.
Well, that episode actually is going to be publishing before the regular Geek Warning episode, I believe. So, if you haven't listened to that one yet, go ahead and cue that one up after you're done with this one, because that one's going to have a whole bunch of really nice little tech details in there. If nothing else, if you get nothing else out of that than understanding DT Swiss's naming conventions, then I feel like that's worth listening to.
Which happens towards the end of the episode.
So just skip all the stuff at the beginning.
Yeah, just skip it all. But yeah, I found some of the info about the spokes quite interesting. So I played a very fun game, which I always like to play with my friends, which is recommend that spoke, where you list a rider and their weight, and you have someone recommend you a spoke for them. It was a riveting game.
This sounds like a game that's probably not going to be marketable very well.
Yeah, okay. It might be a one-off.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll continue on. All right, Dave, during that break, we were talking a little bit about what's on our minds this week. And while we were originally planning to talk about paint, you've got a much more interesting thing to talk about. What did you have on your mind
this
week?
Maybe for some people. I'm sure we will talk about paint at some point. But yeah, I thought, given that Cane Creek just released a suspension fork for gravel bikes, RockShox have just announced an update to their Rudy gravel suspension fork with the new race day 2 damper, which they're a little bit vague as to why you'd want that in the reading I've done, because it might even be heavier than the pre-existing damper, but you can fit it in the old fork. But anyway, I figured I'm keen, James, you seem to be spending a lot of time lately on gravel bikes with suspension forks. I'm currently riding a Santa Cruz Stigmata with a Rudy fork on the front of it. I wanted to get your thoughts on why you'd want a suspension fork on a gravel bike, or why you wouldn't.
You know, we talked a lot about how gravel bikes kind of exist on a spectrum. And I think that still very, very much applies. And it certainly applies to suspension because, again, at one end of the gravel spectrum, you have, you know, pretty smooth gravel roads or packed dirt, that sort of thing. You know, unpaved roads that are arguably almost as smooth as paved roads. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got essentially you're crossing over or kind of butting up into cross-country mountain bike terrain. So it's a pretty wide expanse of stuff that you would ride a quote-unquote gravel bike on. And the topic of front suspension clearly is pretty polarizing because I feel like anytime we write about it, there are always people who are like, get a mountain bike. And then there are other people who are like, this works great. And I think it really just depends on what end of the spectrum you fall on and what end of the spectrum you do your riding on. Because I feel like for me, I actually have two gravel bikes that kind of are at, you know, kind of not quite the extremes of that spectrum. But, you know, at one end, it's kind of more like all-roady kind of bike. I've got an old Allied All-Road that I have 35 mil tires on that I'd say not that long ago, it was considered a gravel bike. And I use that for a lot of smoother terrain, and I definitely don't really feel like I need much suspension on that at all. But at the other end, I got a Lauf Segla that was originally supposed to be for my wife that ended up being for me. She ended up with something else. But anyway, that bike I have been running front suspension on, and it works really pretty well because that bike can run quite bigger tires. I can hit like much bumpier terrain. I can do a lot of trails around here that are, I would say, almost kind of boring on a regular cross country mountain bike, but on a gravel bike with bigger tires and just a little bit of suspension, it's actually really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as underbiking, like if you're into the gravel underbiking, which is basically riding what would have been previously cross-country type terrain, cross-country mountain bike type terrain, but on a gravel bike. Suspension really opens up the speed that you can carry and the momentum that you can carry through that stuff. And it, for me, it just removes a lot of the fatigue that makes that sort of underbiking miserable as well. Like the constant chatter through your upper body. The suspension does a, you know, even if it's just 30 mil travel, does a pretty remarkable job of soaking that up. So yeah, I certainly was gravel skeptic previously, and I'm coming around to the idea of it within a niche case, of people always riding, like, you know, if for those that spend a lot of their gravel time on rough terrain, it seems to actually offer some real genuine benefit that overcomes the weight penalty.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people talk about sort of just how, like, I feel like people who make fun of gravel suspension often kind of pigeonhole it as it just being sort of like this kind of like comfort thing for kind of like older, lazier, kind of less capable riders. But to me, the big thing is,
which can also be true.
It's sure. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But for me, the big thing is just how much more control you get in general, because you know, really one of the big purposes of suspension, yes, is to like increase comfort for the rider. But the other thing is it just keeps that tire patch on the ground. Yeah. And at that point, what I really like about it, again, especially for the type of gravel riding that I'm doing, is that it just lets you go faster. Mm-hmm. It lets you go faster. You don't have to think about it as much. Again, it certainly is more comfortable, but I just have more fun.
Yeah.
And that's for me kind of the name of the game for when I'm riding that bike. I don't really care that much that it's a little bit heavier. I don't really care that much that it might bob a little bit if I'm pedaling out of the saddle. But most of the time when I'm just kind of pedaling along and kind of ripping through, you know, various multi-use unpaved paths and a little bit of single track and that sort of thing, like, it's just fun to ride.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I think, yeah, the takeaway there is it's where you start. It's where your explanation started, which is where on the spectrum you sit for gravel will depend on whether this is a gimmick or whether it actually has genuine benefit. And for me, if I'm riding a gravel bike with the plan to do like a 70% road ride with a few little quick deviations on smooth off-road sections, then don't like it. You know, I find myself reaching down for the lockout, and often that lockout's not as convenient as I want it to be. And then at that point, you're just like, well, I'm carrying all this weight and making the bike look ugly as a result of it. But when I instead go on like fire service trails, which can be pretty rough around here, or I want to go on some single track and I want to go on like a proper mixed off-road terrain ride, which I would have probably historically done on a hardtail, at that point, it completely transforms my experience on a gravel bike. It, yeah, as you say, it's faster, it's more controlled. I can have more fun because I am going faster. And at the same time, my hands aren't feeling it at the end of the ride. So, and that's all things that I can't say the same for say like a suspension stem. You know, a suspension stem feels very limited, and I don't like how it changes the, you know, how a lot of them have a small change in where your handlebars sit or the angle your handlebars sit. You know, suspension fork for me just feels a lot more natural in its action and a lot more reactive. So I'm coming around to the idea of it, but for a very specific use case.
So speaking of that, so you mentioned that you're testing a Santa Cruz Stigmata right now. Mm-hmm. And I think you're kind of getting close to the end of that. But what is intriguing is that you just requested, so that bike that you have came with a RockShox Rudy on up front.
Yeah.
And you just requested the rigid fork.
I did.
From Santa Cruz.
I just got it. I haven't put it on yet. Kind of,
okay. Yep. But what question are you looking to answer with that?
Namely, I mean, one, I want to see how rigid the rigid fork feels. You know, some bikes can feel very, very harsh through the front end. And I want to check that because the Stigmata otherwise feels very well balanced at the moment. And it feels like a fantastic bike. Spoiler alert, it's probably going to be a pretty positive review. But I think, that's one thing I want to test is the ride quality of that rigid fork. But I also want to see like just whether the weight saving of going back to rigid fork, the more traditional ride quality that I guess I'm used to with gravel bikes, whether I prefer that or whether the Stigmata really is a better bike with a suspension fork. I guess, yeah, I'm kind of just keen to see how different the bike becomes without suspension.
I guess that is kind of the question, because we're not really talking about an insignificant weight gain when you're adding a proper suspension fork. Mm-hmm. Because if you figure that carbon fiber rigid gravel forks are typically around like, you know, 450, 500 grams, somewhere around there.
Yep.
A suspension gravel fork at that point is typically around like, well, this Cane Creek, the lightest version is just about a kilo. If you look at something like the Lauf, that's something like 850 or somewhere around there.
Yep.
And then if you look at the Rudy or the Fox 32 taper cast, those are both around like 1200, 1300 or so. So it's quite a bit of added weight.
Yeah.
So really the question is, how much is that added weight worth? Like, well, how much is that extra performance and comfort worth it to you in terms of like having to lug all that around? Because it's not nothing.
No, and yeah, it makes a gravel bike, which should be lighter than a mountain bike, in my opinion, unless you're on something steel that is made for traveling the world. Yeah, it makes a bike that should be lighter into a bike that is arguably approaching mountain bike weights. So that Stigmata I'm testing is not a cheap bike. It's a Force Axis build, and it's got some really nice wheels on it, and it's got some nice components on it, but it's 9.4 kilos before pedals or cages, and that's because it's got an Axis dropper seat post on it, and it's got the fork on the front. It's sort of at that point you've just got a bike that by the time you add pedals is mountain. It's a hardtail mountain bike in terms of weight. So so that's kind of the thing I'm trying to answer, is whether the Stigmata is as good or is a better bike rigid, or whether people should genuinely consider getting it with a suspension fork, and whether it's worth the weight penalty. James, while we're on the subject, I'm kind of keen to hear just a quick little coverage, because I don't think we've discussed the Cane Creek fork, which came out earlier in the week. You've got a write-up online. I found your write-up better than, this is going to sound very biased, so I probably shouldn't say it, but better than others available. So well done. But yeah, I'm keen to hear whether that fork, which is just air sprung with no real traditional damper in it, I'm keen to hear whether you missed having a damper in that fork.
You know, it's hard to say, because just to back up. So yes, Cane Creek did just introduce their own gravel specific suspension fork. They are claiming it's the first like real gravel specific suspension fork, which I would argue Lauf probably owns that title. Mm. But maybe Cane Creek can own the title of the first real gravel specific telescoping suspension fork. Sure. Maybe. So it's an inverted design. It's called the Invert, hence the name. It uses a one piece molded carbon fiber crown and steer that is then has a aluminum upper legs bonded into it, and then kind of overwrapped, and like it's all it looks pretty smooth. Mm. And then it's a bridgeless design, so because it's inverted, and it has aluminum tubes, 30 mil aluminum tubes that come out of the bottom, connected with a regular 12 mil through axle, and then that whole thing goes up and down. So it's pretty light. It's about 1,000 grams, or I think about 1,200 grams, depending on which version you have. So they offer two versions. One is 40 mil travel with what they're calling a climb switch. They're not calling it a lockout. And then they have the lighter version, which is 30 mils of travel and no lockout. And yeah, like you said, it's air sprung, no damper. And in that sense, it's almost kind of similar to earlier iterations of the Specialized Future Shock, in the sense that it's really meant to ideally tackle kind of more like high frequency vibration, washboard, that sort of thing. It's not really meant to be like a big hit fork, like big hit, you know, in relatively speaking for gravel bikes. So while it is certainly lighter and perhaps less fully featured than something like a RockShox Rudy or Fox 32 taper cast, I would almost argue that they are almost different usage cases, because like that Fox I find particularly good when I'm doing a lot of underbiking, because it has, at least as of you know, before RockShox introduced this new damper, it had a nicer damper, I thought, than the Rudy. Kind of offered like a little bit more of a controlled feel.
Sure.
Again, add a weight penalty compared to some other suspension forks, but for underbiking stuff, I thought that fork was awesome.
Mm.
For that sort of terrain, as of right now, I don't know if this Cane Creek is as good, because again, it does not have any damping in it. It also doesn't necessarily feel like the uncontrolled pogo stick. I was kind of thinking it might. But I guess the reason why I reserve assigning final conclusions on it is because I was on a pre-production sample. So King Creek,
okay.
A couple of folks from King Creek came out to Boulder, did a couple of days of riding on local terrain that I know really well. So that was a really good plus. And I personally didn't find the lack of damping to be an issue, which is kind of surprising. Mm. Even on bigger impacts where I kind of expected that there'd be more of a rebound issue. But actually I found as of when I was riding it, it was kind of more of like a bottom out issue on a couple of things, just because I really wanted to play with the spring rate and stuff like that. But it didn't really turn out to be an issue, but there also was a little bit more stiction in that fork than production units are supposed to have. So that may have made up a little bit for the lack of damping. It may have made for like a less bobbying and kind of like overactive ride. So it's a little bit hard for me to say.
Yeah, okay.
Because as of right now, I would say that my hunch right now is that when they become available in production form, which is going to be in late June from King Creek, my suspicion is that I might like the shorter travel and lighter Invert SL version more, mainly because it is lighter. It doesn't have the climb switch in it, and it kind of is really just meant for high frequency vibration stuff. It'll certainly take the edge off of bigger impacts,
sure.
But this is not really ideally what it's meant for. And I kind of wonder if that might do the trick. And I think, I don't know if I'd really want I don't know how much I care about the extra 10 millimeters of travel on the CS version or that climb switch equipped version. Hard to say since again, it was a pre-production sample that I rode.
To be confirmed. To me, like purely on paper, I haven't ridden one, but it seems like perhaps bigger riders, heavier riders, as that spring pressure increases, may miss having a damper more.
It's very possible. Because then at that point, it would be more force extending, trying to re-extend the fork.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only like 72 kilos, something like that. Hard to say. I definitely want to find out more. I'm looking forward to getting on a production version to kind of get a little bit more time on it and see what it's like. But I would say as of right now, however, I'd say my first impressions of that fork was really quite positive. It's certainly better than I expected it to be.
Yeah.
It does, relatively speaking, it does look pretty good. It is, you know, one of King Creek's big goals with having that inverted design is to have it look a little bit more seamless with higher end carbon gravel bikes. And I think it does do that. You know, a lot of the comments from our members who left comments on that article also said that it did seem to look pretty good. To be determined, but initial impressions are pretty good. So okay. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how much I miss the damper.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I guess to wrap up the chat on gravel forks, I think, not for everyone, but more than a gimmick. And I would encourage anyone that is super skeptical on anything cycling related to try and ride said thing before becoming a internet warrior against it.
And again, just keeping in mind that because gravel encompasses such a wide range of types of riding that, you know, I always have to try and keep in mind that the type of riding that I do may not necessarily be the type of riding somebody else does.
For sure.
So it's always just kind of important to keep in mind, like the whole horses for courses thing, like something that works for me might not work for you and vice versa. So anyway, just be open-minded a little bit about it, I think. Dave, let's move on to our PSA this week, which is sort of related in a sense, I guess mechanically. Things that go up and down, indeed. So this may be one that I think we talked about before, but I think it's worth repeating. I recently had a friend's mountain bike in, I was kind of fixing it up for her, and was able to pretty much tackle everything on it that I needed to, but her dropper seat post is seemingly beyond easy repair. And I think it's purely because it never got regular servicing. Mm-hmm. And so this PSA this week is just a reminder that your dropper seat post needs some love too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just suspension forks. And I know we've talked about that several times and people seem pretty well aware that those need fairly regular maintenance. But from a mechanical standpoint, a lot of the things that are in a dropper post are also in a suspension fork, and it needs a similar amount of maintenance, I think.
Yep. Especially given your rear wheel is chucking grit on it all the time.
Exactly. And you have an awful lot of cantilevered load on it, mm-hmm. just because you're sitting on it and the seat tube's at an angle that, you know, drop receipt post just by virtue of the fact that there's just one telescoping tube. They have a bunch of, they usually have a bunch of keys in there, be that like brass or plastic or whatever, to keep it from rotating. And those need to be lubricated. They need to be cleaned. They need to be replaced on occasion. You've got cartridges in there that may or may not need to be repressurized every now and then. You've got cartridges that have oil in them that may sometimes not have the oil in them that they're supposed to. But either way, I think if your drop receipt post has not been getting a whole lot of maintenance, or like say you don't remember the last time you did any maintenance on it, I think if you were to go to a bike shop and go check out a new drop receipt post on a bike on the floor, you might be surprised at how much better it's supposed to work than what yours is working like right now.
Yeah, if you're having to wait for it to extend, then it's it could be better.
Yeah, or you, if you have, or in the case of this particular dropper, if you had to like pull up on it to get the last 15 millimeters of extension, that's a pretty bad sign too.
Yeah, and if it's not like a PNW Coast C post or like the RockShox Reverb gravel version, then it shouldn't have any bounce in it at the top.
It should not. It's correct. Yeah. And the thing with dropper seat posts is a lot of them are awfully easy to service too. So most of these companies have online instructions available. But a lot of times all you really have to do is kind of just keep that stanchion clean, keep the seal clean. And for many of them, doing just the most basic service is like a lot of times you can kind of unscrew that seal head assembly, oftentimes just by hand. Mm-hmm. You can kind of just unscrew that, slide it up, clean things out underneath there as best you can, reapply some suspension lube. I always prefer to use that Buzzy's Slick Honey stuff. It seems to be kind of the sort of the industry standard. Yep. And then kind of work it in there a little bit and put the seal back on, and then you're good to go. So it's literally a 5-minute job. Mm-hmm. And it does immense wonders. It absolutely does wonders toward keeping those things working well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's definitely the most common issue with dropper seat posts is like abrasion wear is what I'd say is sort of what kills them. And yeah, sort of not doing that thing that James just said, which is like, you know, removing that top seal head and cleaning underneath and removing the grit out of there. That's sort of what's will ensure an early death of the dropper post. So yeah, easy repair to do. You don't actually, for most droppers on the market, you can just leave the post in place and just do it with it in the bike. You don't have to remove anything. You're just literally unscrewing that top collar and yeah, just a quick clean and grease, and it'll greatly extend the life of your dropper. But yeah, check the user manual, check the manual of your dropper, make sure that it does actually have a seal head that's meant to be unscrewed, because not every dropper does. Like off the top of my head, Wolftooth's new dropper doesn't have that feature. But most do.
Yep. So easy fix, but something that can certainly bite you later if you ignore it. All right, Dave, let's get to the end of the show here. We got some other news, little bits of news that we want to wrap up with here. All right, first up in our last little news segment here, Belgian internally geared hub brand Classified, certainly a brand that most people will have heard of by now. They continue to be on a bit of a roll here as far as growing its collection of wheel partners. So they've now added Envy to the list. So if you've been interested in Classified's 2-speed rear hub, but you're maybe kind of hoping to get it with some Envy rims, your numbers come up. So Envy's going to offer these Classified hubs in road and gravel builds at the Foundation, SES, and G-Series levels, not only in just wheels, but you can also get them as stock builds on the Mog, Melee, and Frey complete bikes. Mm.
Yeah, it's great to see more options still. And yeah, I think if you look at Classified's partner list of wheel brands that now support the hub shell as stock, and then you buy the gut separately from Classified, it's a very long list now.
It almost seems to be the list almost seems to be shorter now of major brands that don't work with Classified than you do.
Yeah, I think you're missing Shimano and SRAM Zip, obviously, for very obvious reasons, because a shifting system is arguably a competitor to them. But yeah, otherwise
I wouldn't even say arguably, it just is.
Yeah. But otherwise, yeah, there's not a lot of major wheel brands missing off that list now.
Yeah, so it's always fun to see more options there. So yeah, like again, if you've been hoping for a Classified and Envy combo, now's your time. Dave, we've talked a little bit about sort of telescoping and suspension and dropper seat post things. What's up with RockShox? They just dropped some news here.
Yeah, they've brought the Silo back, which is an old name that, James, you would definitely remember.
Oh, yes. It
brings back
absolutely
good nostalgia for me on having a trail bike with one of these. But the Silo they've brought back is, and the domain name they've also brought back, but they've brought back valley-orientated trail and sort of all-mountain enduro forks, single crown forks with, extended travel. That Silo is a 35 millimeter stanchion fork and something you'll probably find on more budget oriented mountain bikes moving forward. But it's cool to see them bring that name back. I kind of had wondered when they would, because it was such a successful fork about a decade ago.
Well, I am glad that they didn't bring back sort of like the weird gold color that they had. Mm-hmm. I guess Fox kind of owns that now a little bit.
Like, yeah,
it's not
a little
quite
bit
the same shade.
Yeah.
Not quite the same shade, but that old Silo gold was, I would say, never really quite super appealing to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, yeah, we've also mentioned already, but they have updated the damper in the Rudy fork, which now has a damper that's more in line to the lightweight performance focused damper that you find in their SID suspension forks.
And then speaking of suspension, Fox has some stuff new, some new stuff too.
Yeah.
So we did talk a whole bunch about their new forks, or I guess new dampers specifically. Mm. And now we're looking at the other end of the bike. Fox, so what do we have there?
Fox has been busy. Yeah. New Fox transfer dropper, complete overhaul to the transfer dropper. It had a bit of a, what would you say? It's sort of got a not stellar reputation, a reputation that doesn't quite meet Fox's name, the previous transfer dropper.
In terms of reliability,
it had sort of some air leakage issues, which they are solving in market. It seems that if you do have one of those older posts with such an issue, you should get in touch with your shop and get that sorted. But this new dropper is fully overhauled. So they now have more sizing. It goes up to much longer dropper posts as well. So it's the size ranges from 120 to 240 mil drops. They've got a dedicated 34.9 millimeter size now for those frames running the big size. It's a full rebuild. So you've now got a externally adjustable air pressure from the top. You do have to remove the saddle to get to it, but you can now adjust the return speed and dial that in, which you couldn't previously. It's all new air seals inside, more user serviceable than before. The previous version required quite a few proprietary tools. It looks really good. And my favorite feature with new droppers is adjustable travel. So say you get the 180 mil version and you end up not being able to use it because your frame limits it too much and you can't actually comfortably pedal at that full 180 mil height, you can add 5 millimeter spaces to this to reduce that height and dial in exactly how much drop you can fit in your frame. And that spacer setup is really cool. They're just like split rings that you just fit underneath that seal head. So you're literally just unscrewing the seat post, the seal head with the seat post in the frame, and then you drop these little rings in and that's all you're doing. A really neat system as far as adjustable height seat posts go.
Yeah, super, super quick and easy. So like we said earlier, just as easy as it is to unscrew that seal head and kind of clean and relube, that's mm-hmm. how quickly you can reduce the travel on that new Fox transfer. So pretty clever.
Yep.
Speaking of working on stuff, Dave, one of your favorite brands, EVT, they just dropped a new product that I think was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
What's that? And do you have one in your garage yet?
Sadly not. I if they're listening, Brett, if you're listening, I don't think you are listening, but if you are listening, I would love to test this. Yeah, so EVT, Efficient Fellow Tools, they've taken their relatively famous right arm clamp, which fits on park tool shop stands and also on their own telescoping work stand, which is quite cool. Sorry, their work stand isn't technically telescoping. Height adjustable work stand, we'll call it. They've come out with a portable work stand, which looks kind of cool. It's a very familiar tripod design, but it brings their right arm clamp to outside, which looks quite nice. And it's not the exact right arm clamp that you'd find in stores. It is modified for this more portable stand, but yeah, $600 US, and the stand looks like it yeah, would survive an apocalypse. It's got a lot of steel involved in it. It's got a bunch of very large aluminium tubes. All the like the quick releases to adjust the height look really high quality, really sturdy. And yeah, just knowing EVT, how robust this stuff is, I'm sure it's these stands are going to be around for a very long time. Some of my favorite features, there's peg holes in the feet of the stands, so you can really secure that stand into soft flooring if you need to, if you're in the
concrete.
In the
concrete.
Yep. If you want to just drill it straight into the concrete, you can do that. If you want to hammer tent pegs into it, you can do that and then lose all your small bits into the grass beneath. But yeah, I think that ride-on clamp could bring something new to the portable workstand space. But yeah, certainly this one is aimed at the professional, probably the professional demo fleet worker, the professional charity ride mechanic, someone that's working on a large variety of bikes that also needs portability.
And Dave Rome.
And me.
So. All right. And finally, on the news front, if you're regularly locking up a bike somewhere, you're worried about roving thieves equipped with cordless angle grinders, as you should be. OnGuard's got a new rock solid lock that might be of interest. So this thing is interesting because it is encased in some sort of like proprietary diamond coating, which is what OnGuard's calling it.
It does
sound expensive. That's what I said too. But that coating supposedly keeps angle grinders from cutting through the shackle and stuff. It's also claimed to be the lightest angle grinder resistant lock on the market. It's just 1.4 kilos, just over 3 pounds. It's actually not nearly as expensive as I thought it'd be, given that diamond coating. It's $200 US as compared to $300 US for Hip Lock's version of an angle grinder resistant lock, the D1000. So that sounds kind of neat, actually. Haven't checked the dimensions on that. I think it might be a little bit on the smaller side. I've got to look. But either way, I certainly live in a town where angle grinders are being used to steal bikes, and that would be a good one to have because I don't know. My Urban Arrow is the only bike that I really leave locked up around town, and I'd be very sad if someone walked away with that thing.
Yeah. They wouldn't easily walk away with it. It's quite large.
Not very easily. They'd need a crew.
Yeah.
But, you know, two people can carry that pretty easily.
Yes.
Anyway.
It does fit in a U-Haul. Not to give anyone ideas, but it does fit in a U-Haul.
All right, well, that'll do it for this week's episode of Geek Warning. So thanks as always for listening, and an even bigger thanks if you're one of our Escape Collective members. So you may or may not have noticed that there are no ads in this show, nor will you see any ads breaking up the written content on escapecollective.com. And that's because we are a 100% member-funded operation. So members not only get full access to our kind of full suite of written content and podcasts, but you also get that kind of warm and fuzzy feeling you get by supporting a media publication that actually works for you, not advertisers or affiliate partners, because yes, that is a thing. If you're not a member, it's super quick and easy. It doesn't cost a ton. Just head over to escapecollective.com/join and enter a few bits of information and you're good to go. And if you've been enjoying what we've been bringing you to you since we launched in March last year, I'm going to virtually give you that look of supreme disappointment that I get every time, say, I go to Taiwan and have to sheepishly admit to someone that I don't speak Chinese. And I can speak from lots of experience that you don't want that look. It's like you're somehow letting down an entire country or culture or something. It's very unnerving. For the rest of you responsible folks, thanks as always for listening. And we'll see you next week for
James,
another episode of Geek Warning.
Did you just say people that aren't members of Escape Collective are letting down an entire country?
That was the insinuation.
Is that the
yes.
gist of it?
Yeah, kind of.
No.
You just don't want that look. It's
extreme.
A very bad look, Dave.
Yeah, okay.
Like, I can't tell you how many times I've gone to Taiwan for a Taipei show or visit family or whatever. And, I mean, I look Asian very clearly. And people are talking to me in Mandarin or Taiwanese. And I have to look at them and be like, sorry, ABC kid, American-born Chinese. And they just kind of look at me like, you have let all of us down. It's a very distinct look. I don't like it. And that's the look I'm giving people who haven't signed up yet.
Wow. All right.
How's that for the hard sell?
That's a pretty hard sell. I would say, whether you're a member, thank you, or not, nothing for you. If you liked what we do with this episode, or the podcast in general, and you got some friends that don't listen, please tell them about it. Yeah, we can always have more listeners. So that's what you can do. If you're a member, please spread the word. If you're not a member, please support what we do.
Sounds good. That was a much gentler sell, Dave.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I can do that in comfort now that everyone's already switched off. So
perfect. Awesome. All right. Well, again, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week for another episode of Geek Warning.
Thank you.